Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Okay, welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I am delighted to be joined by Justin McGuire. This is Justin's second time on the show, but I'll do a quick recap of his bio. Justin is the CEO and founder of MCG Talent, a talent consulting firm specializing in creative communications and marketing people across the Middle East and Asia. Justin spent 7 years working for well-known creative agencies before jumping into recruitment, which he's done for the last 15 years. He's lived and worked across the UK, Europe, Central America, Singapore, and is now based from Dubai. Justin's run his own recruiting firm for 12 years, and I'm really excited to have you back on the show, Justin. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Hi, good to be with you again.
Fantastic. So, it's hard to believe it's been almost 2 years since we last did this. It was November 2020, episode 42, for those who want to go back and revisit our previous conversation. But your business has changed dramatically since then, so we're definitely overdue for a catch-up. And we should also give a shout out to Helen McGuire, who has been on the show. That was episode 57. And that episode was called Diversity as a Differentiator, How Recruiters Can Attract 70% More Diverse Talent. So I think you're using Helen's podcast setup this morning.
I am. Yes, I borrowed my wife's microphone. So hopefully she didn't need to use it today because I shot out the house with it in my hand.
All right, fantastic. Hopefully she won't need it. So look, Justin, let's pick up where we left off. Can you bring me up to speed on like the last couple of years, you know, the changes you've made and the current size and shape of your business and what you guys are doing?
Sure. So Mark, last time we spoke, the world was in a quite a different place then. I was physically in a different place then. I was actually living in Singapore. And our business at the time was called DMCG Global, and we were part of a global network of about sort of 55 recruiters, and now obviously we're called MCG Talent. So we've left that setup that we had and moved on and done our own thing and become specialists. You know, really focused on becoming specialists for the Middle East and Asia in the marcoms and tech world. So that's the world that we recruit in. And we are sort of experts within the Middle East and Asia. And we decided to leave the global group that we were part of, just because I think during COVID, we really sort of understood the need for a niche where we were doing well and where people were leaning on us was that they wanted experts within the Middle East and Asia to guide and hold their hand and talk to them about what's going on in that area that we knew so well. And we just thought, you know, rather than being part of a global offering, let's just button down on being experts within the bits that we know really well. And it served us well in COVID, and it served us well ever since, really. So since then, I think when we last spoke from a Middle East and Asia perspective, we had about headcount of about 12. And today we're sat around about 30 people and are growing still. So we brought 8 people into the business last month and are looking to sort of bring 2 or 3 more over on this coming month as well. So it's the business name has changed, but our focus really has been on buttoning down on marcoms and technology within the Middle East and Asia.
Love it. So you've got a team of 30. I know you're based in Dubai. You also have the Singapore office.
Yeah.
And are there any others, or is it Singapore and Dubai?
And Hong Kong.
Oh, and Hong Kong, of course.
Yeah. So it's been a really, obviously the regions that we've worked in have all had a different COVID, and have all, most of them have sprung. So Singapore and Dubai have sprung back now as hubs. Quarantine has just ended in Hong Kong. So I might be able to go and see my colleagues there for the first time since 2019. But Hong Kong has taken some time to open up, but I think we can really see the green shoots of recovery now coming over there. It's been what's been quite fascinating, though, is that the Hong Kong, our business in Hong Kong has actually done pretty well over this period. But the guys and girls that work there just haven't been able to travel. And I think that's probably been the toughest thing on them, is their mental health and just feeling the constraints of COVID that not many of us are living through now.
Absolutely. It's interesting how different parts of the world have experienced this differently and are in different stages of recovery and resurgence. So what's cool, I think you are the first person I've had on the show that really specializes or is expert in Middle East and Asia. What's it like recruiting in that region, and how does it differ to, say, UK, Europe, you know, where you're from originally?
Yeah, I think so. I've been an expat, if it's called that, for 14 years now. So moved originally, you know, having worked in recruitment, or first of all, creative agencies and digital agencies. And then I worked in recruitment. I moved into recruitment just because I couldn't find a recruiter in the UK in the mid 2000s that really understood what I did in content marketing. So I thought, right, well, there must be an opportunity here to open up a recruitment business. And then when the financial crisis happened in 2008, the founders of the recruitment business that I worked for in London were in the financial services sector. So they got smashed, is probably the best way I can say it, by the financial crisis. And I saw that there was this place where the cranes didn't stop moving called Dubai, and thought that should be a good place to go and live and work. And basically got offered a job out here over the telephone. So I landed here in 2008, having never been to Dubai before. Not even done much reading, actually, which probably I should have done. So when the doors to the airport opened and I got in, it was September and still, you know, 40 odd degrees here. I knew it was going to be hot, but I'd never felt anything like that before. But I arrived here, and it was a crazy world, right? It was people were becoming sort of at the time millionaires in 6 months, and you were reading all, you know, and there were genuinely cranes everywhere, and I couldn't quite get my, you know, you open up a bank account and the bank manager said you should borrow lots of money and invest in an apartment. And of course, then everything went crashing down. And I thought, oh my gosh, what have I done? Have I packed up the recession and put it in my suitcase and brought it out here? But after about, you know, I'd say a good 6 to 8 months of being here, it was, green shoots were starting to come through. And that's because Abu Dhabi had flicked sort of Dubai a load of money, and all of a sudden it's, you know, its debts had gone. And I found myself, having sort of managed to survive doing odds and sods jobs out here, I found myself in a position where I felt perfectly suited to kind of set up a niche out here as a marcoms and advertising recruitment specialist, because there just wasn't anyone here doing it. Everyone had left when the recession happened. You know, it was well reported at the time that people were dumping their cars at the airport, etc. So I was kind of like, yeah, so I was sort of last person standing, it felt like, and actually it served me quite well. And it's because I'd left the firm in the UK and knew that there wasn't, you know, the market in the UK was still quite damaged. And I thought, well, if I stay in Dubai, at least I can get a suntan and see it out, you know. And it proved to be quite a shrewd move. So I stuck it out. And then in 2010, I decided to launch my own business, which was great because I was probably the first specialist out here. So what, you know, I think what served me really well was that sort of first mover advantage being in Dubai, particularly after a recession when so many people had left, that I had the guts, would you say, to open up. It was quite hard to structure the ownership of a business then. So I had to go into a partnership with a local, which was, you know, and you hear some horror stories and you heard some okay stories. And I just, you know, I put all my chips on red and hoped that it came through. And fortunately, that partnership worked out well. And then I actually ended up spending most of the time in the UK, because of course it was great being the first person to set up a niche here, but there wasn't really much talent here, particularly if it was in digital. So I was relocating people from the UK out to the Middle East. And that's, you know, that's really how I got going.
When you say relocating people, do you mean to work for you in your business, or you were relocating talent to work for your clients?
Yeah, good question. So obviously I set up myself as an expert marcoms and creative recruiter in the Middle East. And it was, I had loads of people interested in my services, but I didn't have much talent here.
Right, I see.
And particularly the type of roles that I was getting briefed on were sort of non-Arabic positions, but very technically. They wanted technical specialists within those field, or creative directors who'd worked on particular campaigns. And I could only really find those in Europe. And, you know, because I'd worked in the industry for 7 years, I was really able to leverage on my experience and contacts. LinkedIn, you know, was quite handy, but it still wasn't the power machine that it is now. So I leveraged into my contacts, and I started relocating, you know, 3 to 5 people a month out here.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. And I was, you know, we had a fantastic run of it. And that's how I set up and got the business going. And my passion for the Middle East, you know, really sort of started from when I grew the business. And it's, you know, it's a bit of a, it was a crazy place to launch a business, because everything was kind of raw. Everything was new. The, you know, things move either, it's very volatile. Okay. So things either move really fast, really, and you can become successful very quickly, or they can fall off a cliff just as quickly, right? And you get companies that arrive and leave, and you have to really sort of be very clever about who you work with in this part of the world, because sometimes professionalism can be lacking in certain individuals, or getting paid can be really hard. You know, payment terms, people can sign a terms and conditions document, agree to pay you in 30 days, but that doesn't mean that they will pay you in 30 days. And neither is there much protection for them to be able to do that, for you to be able to claim your money. Sorry. So
I've got a story about that. I'll tell you in a few minutes, but
yeah, I think that's one of the challenges, you know, getting paid is one of the challenges a lot of people face in the Middle East. And the other thing is it's a small pond. So you have to do a good job for everyone, because, you know, if you do a good job, people hear about it very quickly. If you do a bad job, people hear about it equally quickly. And yes. I was quite fortunate in that, because I've worked in the industry, I was able to network in the right circles and do a good job for people. So I got referred loads of my business. And that, I think, was the key to the success, was that being, you know, doing a good job and being referred to the right people. Now, my staff hear me say this all the time, but, you know, I remind them that Dubai's population is similar to that of Sheffield, you know, so it is quite small. And even though it's glitz and glamorous, you know, you have to keep in mind that you have to always be business developing in this part of the world, because the businesses aren't as big as they are in London. So you always need to find new clients. And if you do a good job for someone, they probably won't need to service you until they grow again. So you've always got to be looking for new areas to go into. And also, it's the hub for the wider GCC region, you know, and that means that you get access to Qatar and Saudi.
What's GCC, Justin?
So the GCC is the Gulf Corporation Council. Okay. So those essentially are the countries, the oil producing countries. So you've got the UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and Oman. Okay. Those are the wealthy countries that are now investing in diversifying their economies. And that's where a lot of business opportunities come from. And Dubai at the moment really serves as the main hub for those regions, with Saudi and Qatar probably, you know, and Abu Dhabi competing with Dubai now for that title.
Interesting. So what's been the biggest thing that either shocked you or you had to adapt to in building a successful business in that region?
I mean, there's so many things. It's bringing, you know, also, first of all, it's, you know, establishing yourself as a niche expert when people were really only used to working with Michael Page, Robert Walters, or, you know, those guys, or Hayes that were here. It's then justifying your fee, because, you know, people see that you're a small business. They think they can pay you peanuts. It's then having to sort of define how a recruitment business, less so now, but back in the day, it was how a recruitment business actually works. you know, and why we get our fee and what we can bring to the table. And, you know,
so it's kind of educating a market that's not as mature
for
recruiting services.
Big part of doing that. And then as we grew, it was then looking to take that and start servicing clients in Saudi or in other parts of the region that were really important to those businesses as well, and showing that you could do a good job for them. One of the challenges as well has been showing that you can understand the local culture, the ways of doing business, that you can respect that. You know, some of the companies that we work for are real melting pots as well, because in this part of the world, for example, in the UAE, most businesses that we work with don't have UAE nationals that work for them, so they're all expats. So you'll have some companies that will have 30 to 40, maybe more, different nationalities working in their office, and you've got to understand how all those different cultures can work together. You know, you've got to know what corners of the world to get people from. You've got to understand where specific strengths. And, you know, for example, we moved a lot of Latin Americans to Dubai, and, you know, and there is a huge Latin population within the creative sector. But people wouldn't know that, right?
I had no idea about that.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's understanding where you can get people from, why people would want to move here. So you not only need to know the culture of the Middle East, but you then, because a lot of the talent that you're relocating is from other parts of the world, you need to understand that culture as well. And that was a real big difference from recruiting in the UK, where I was really recruiting within the M25, if I'm honest with you, and there was an abundance of candidates to find within that. And, you know, if I found a candidate in North London, they might not want to work in South London. And whereas in, you know, if I'm relocating for Saudi, I might have to find someone in Australia or, you know, Canada, et cetera. And it's, you know, different worlds.
Wow. That's so cool. So I don't know if I told you the story. I spent about a week in Dubai, but this is years and years ago. Yeah. I was invited by, I'm not going to name the company. It was a French recruitment company who had set up in Dubai. And there was two partners, and one of them was a big fan of mine, and he like was super enthusiastic. I didn't ever meet or know the other partner. They wanted me to train their sort of senior consultants and you know, consultants, and like I delivered like a 3 or 4 day program for them. It was so interesting. Like, just it felt, I'd never been anywhere in the Middle East before, and it felt completely alien to me. Just like, even just sort of navigating the nuance of how to interact with people. And, you know, I found that really interesting, but quite difficult. And the sessions went well, but unfortunately then immediately after, almost like the week after I left and came back to Scotland, the partner split up, and the guy who was left didn't want to pay me. Yeah. And I had this whole, because he was like, as far as he was concerned, they didn't need training, and he had never, you know, agreed to the training and so on. But anyway, I just had to harass him until he relented. But
did he eventually relent?
Yeah. But I mean, there's nothing I really could have done. Like, if he had decided not to pay me, then I'm in another country. There's not really.
It's tough. It's tough. Yeah. And I think that's been one of the you know, one of the challenges that the region has had sometimes in attracting business is because of this fear of not being paid. Now, I'm delighted to say that actually, coming out of COVID, I really think, you know, if it's possible to say that the region, particularly Dubai, had a good COVID, and that a lot of businesses have been attracted here. They were very smart. You know, I was living in Singapore and Asia, which was much of a, you know, in lockdown mode then, and the middle Dubai especially sort of went into open up mode. They saw a real opportunity in opening their economy as quickly as possible. So I think by June or July 2020, they were announcing they were open for business. Tourists were coming here, you know, and they were screened and checked very carefully. But what they also did was they opened up visas that invited people to work here. So they had a remote working visa, which a lot of people took advantage of and came here and actually went, you know what, it's actually quite nice. You know, it's not steaming hot as I thought it always would be. That actually in the winter months, it's really pleasant. And a lot of people stayed. I think a lot of people stayed in Airbnbs and extended that. And so when I came back here, after Singapore last year, I was just quite surprised by just how full Dubai was. Now, believe it or not, we couldn't find a villa. Now, if I remember what I told you at the beginning of this story when I moved out here, that there was, this was the land of, you know, where a quarter of the world's cranes were. So the fact that we couldn't find a villa tells you how full Dubai, you know, was. It was just bonkers, really. But there we go. Half of the story of our business isn't just the Middle East, but it's Asia as well.
Because you've got offices in different countries and culturally completely different, like how have you made that work?
Yeah, so actually, if you look at back, so in we set up our Asia business in 2016, and at the time, if you were looking at where expats went, it was the sort of competition between the main competition that we were finding was Dubai, Hong Kong, and Singapore. So we always had, you know, Asia in our mind because we were talking to talent. And if the talent was considering to relocate, they had opportunities in either Singapore or Hong Kong as well. That's where they were open to work. So we thought, right, if we're really good at bringing people into Dubai, why can't we try and be really good at bringing people into Hong Kong? And then I found a fantastic person to work with called Adam, who's now my business partner and a shareholder in our firm. And he wanted to go and move to Hong Kong and set up our Asia business. So he came and stayed with us in Dubai for a month in August, I remember it was, and he'd never felt heat like it. I don't think he wondered what he'd landed in. But he then moved to Hong Kong and leveraged off all our relationships that we had in the Middle East and some of his own that he had. And he built this really fantastic business that was a replica of what we were doing in the Middle East over in Hong Kong. And it was just quite different. There were similarities and differences. So similarities in the sense that, you know, it was a regional hub. So we were recruiting, although we were based in Hong Kong, we were servicing about 40% of our clients in Southeast Asia. So that hub element, the way Dubai serves as the hub for the MENA region and Hong Kong or Singapore serve as the hub for the Asia Pacific region, we really were able to help businesses find talent because we really understood how that operation worked. If they needed to relocate talent, we could get our hands on just about anyone from anywhere because of our Middle East experience. But what we really saw as a difference was actually there was a demand for localized talent, and you know, both Singapore and Hong Kong really wanted us to find local talent. So that was a big difference in our business from the Middle East, that we really built and have built and continue to build a really strong localized database as well. And actually fast forward to today, and that's actually what's made our businesses quite very successful in Asia, is that we've got really good localized talent, because what COVID did in Hong Kong because of the lockdowns and the exodus of expat talent, and in Singapore with the, you know, the government essentially getting elected on a mandate to make more jobs for Singaporeans, you had to, you know, in order to get an expat ticket, if you want to call it that, for a visa, you have to show that you employ lots of locals. We had to really only service the local market. And that today is, I think, a big difference between our Middle East and Asia business, is that in the Middle East, it's about 50-50 expat to local talent that we get.
Interesting.
Whereas in Asia, it's much less than that. The expat movement that we get there is probably about 15%.
Wow. Okay, that's interesting. Justin, I wanted to ask you, like, are most of your clients multinationals, or are they like UAE companies or Hong Kong companies? Like, what's the mix there?
Yeah, so our clients are made of, there's four different groups of our clients from an industry perspective. You've got agencies, be those advertising, creative, PR agencies; consultancies, be those management consultancies or smaller niche advisory firms. Corporates, they could be multinational businesses or big local family holding groups in the various different regions. And the last one is technology brands, be those startups or established brands. And those four groups are really our main client base. And I would say probably the corporates, you've got real, you know, in the Middle East, the family holding groups are very powerful. But likewise in Asia, it's exactly the same. Actually, there's a big similarity there, that you've got a lot of wealth that's maintained within certain families, and they have these huge diverse portfolios where you find they've got investments into energy, investments into property, investments into, gosh, just about anything, and you can work with one of those niches as well. So I think it's quite broad now, our client mix of local and international businesses. I think as the market probably gets a bit tighter next year, we're probably going to be more localized, working with more localized brands as opposed to international. Because what I find in the emerging world is you get a lot of a lot of the big international firms do a reorg of talent and bring out, then move people internally to markets that are still doing well. And I certainly expect the Middle East and Asia to be quite resilient moving forward. I mean, you know, if you look at energy prices and you look at the way that the markets are behaving in Southeast Asia and with Hong Kong opening up and hopefully China as well, I think they're going to be, you know, I think we're going to be perhaps suffer less from the effects of inflation that other parts of the world are suffering from right now. That's not to say if Mr. Putin doesn't do a few silly things, but, I think we feel quite positive about where things are going.
It's interesting because I suppose, correct me if I'm wrong, Justin, whereas higher energy prices have an adverse effect on most of the world, I guess in the Middle East, it might actually have a positive effect in terms of driving growth.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, it's what publicized now. If you have a look at, you know, I think Aramco announced like 90% profits. That's the Saudi Arabia, you know, the company that controls all the oil that comes out of Saudi Arabia. But all the Middle East economies right now have managed to restore their coffers and are quite buffered up, you know. I think the fact that energy prices have been quite high serves them really well and allows them to spend on diversification projects, which is what we are working on a lot of those right now. You know, that investment into technology, building new cities, these huge giga projects, these big announcements, that's serving the Middle East region, you know, incredibly well. And actually, we're very busy on the back of it. Likewise, you've also got this interesting episode where we've had an influx of Russians that come to Dubai as well with what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. And it's similarly in Singapore, actually. You've had a real influx of people coming from Hong Kong and China who have entered, you know, very wealthy people who've moved or set up family offices or set up businesses in Singapore, which is deemed a real safe haven as well. And that in essence has flooded that market with a lot of liquidity as well. So it's interesting that where two of our offices are, say Singapore and Dubai, they're deemed, I would seem, and what I've seen over the years is safe havens, you know. So when the world's in perhaps a bit of a pickle, or when trouble is seen on the horizon, they actually tend to do quite well and they reverse it. So that's a role that Hong Kong used to play as a gateway into China. I think it's quite hard to see where that's going to go now. I do think it will spring back quite a bit when China opens up, actually, and it will still genuinely be that gateway to China, albeit in a different guise to how it used to be before. But I think those, particularly Singapore and Dubai right now, we're seeing them do quite well when perhaps other parts of the world are a little bit nervous.
Interesting. Justin, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Adam and how he's become a partner in the business and so on.
Yeah.
And this, of course, expanding internationally, you can only be in one place at a time. And
yeah,
like you could fly, you know, spend all your time flying around, you know, restrictions allowing to different countries. Obviously, Hong Kong has been out of bounds for that. But alternatively, you need strong local leadership, trust someone who you completely trust and who shares the same values and is going to be the representative of your culture and your ethos in that location. And that's very difficult to find. A lot of companies that I've seen who've tried to expand and failed, it's because they didn't get that part right. And so how did you A, find Adam? Did you know him previously? And B, how did you make sure that he was going, that you had this shared like vision of how things should run?
Well, the honest answer is, I found Adam through a referral. Okay. And I actually reached out to, so to get to success, you have to go through a lot of failures. I know it sounds quite cliche, but it's true, right? Yeah. You have to kiss a few frogs as well. So I actually, in a weird way, I reached out to Adam to open up a London business that I was looking to do back in the day. Okay. So my, you know, I think in 2016, I thought I was James Caan, you know, in expansion mode, or who knows, right? So I was planning on opening up London and Hong Kong at the same time. And I approached Adam as he was referred to me. And Adam said, actually, no, I want to go to Asia. And I sort of went, oh, well, that's interesting, because Asia's on my agenda as well. And actually, and I ended up immediately talking to Adam about Hong Kong. And that we opened up in London as well. And that didn't go very well. I closed that after a year, but Hong Kong was doing great. And that's because Adam, you know, as luck would have it, and after sort of five interviews and staying with us in Dubai, I really saw that we had a lot in common, and that we have a serious drive to be successful, you know. And I don't want to, that sounds a bit corny, but I met a partner in Adam that I knew he worked as hard as me, that we shared the same values, that we wanted to do a good job. We were all about quality over quantity. We were all about being experts in our field. And Adam, I come from a content marketing and creative background. Adam comes from a design background. So we kind of shared that the fact that we both worked in industry as well. So there was a lot of similarities, and that's, you know, that's how it's worked so well to date, is that we laugh together, we cry together, you know, and I think we're completely honest with each other. And that's enabled us to become very successful in Asia as well. Now, the challenge that Adam's faced over the past, say, 2.5 years with the Asia Pacific business is that, you may recall, just before COVID happened, that Hong Kong, the riots started in Hong Kong.
Yeah, politically.
A very, very distant memory now. But before COVID, we already had the riots on the streets that we were, you know, so it was becoming, a bit of a tough place to recruit for, where particularly if you're looking to bring expat talent in. So we really, that's why, we opened up Singapore, because we saw we had 40% of our revenue from Hong Kong coming out of Southeast Asia. But we were doing it unmanned, first of all. Then we opened up a license there. And then when the riot started, that's when we started to really staff up there. When I say really staff up, we put about 4 or 5 people there. And then obviously COVID came down. And I was one of those 4 or 5 people in Singapore, by the way. So I, myself, my wife and 2 kids at the time, we moved there to grow that. And then COVID happened. And of course, we all got shut off. The idea was that I was going to be coming backwards and forwards to Dubai and helping, you know, softly leave Dubai for Singapore, and Adam would be come flying over from Hong Kong to Singapore a lot and to help us grow that. And as it happened, we all got marooned.
and
I ended up, I hadn't been in Singapore long enough to really build out the business as I hoped to do there, and I ended up being called into Dubai work a lot. So I was doing a lot of remote work for Dubai from Singapore, and Adam was doing a lot of Singapore work remote from Hong Kong. So that's how we eventually, you know, over time, it made sense for me to move back to Dubai and to focus on building that, and for Adam to actually, what we built in Hong Kong is now a business that, yes, it serves Hong Kong, but also about 50 to 60% of our revenue, given the month that we're talking about, comes from Southeast Asia. So we actually have more of a remote business right now in Hong Kong that serves Southeast Asia. And that's how we managed to grow through COVID, is that we pivoted, I hate to use that word, everyone seems to use it, but we pivoted out of Hong Kong being a China-reliant business, China-Hong Kong-reliant business, and more into being a Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia, and elements of Hong Kong as well business. To the point that now we're going back to the plan of getting people on the ground into Singapore. So our next hire will be, hires, shall I say, will be, you know, between 2 and 4 people that we'll put into Singapore. And they will be people that are familiar and local with the market there, and hopefully a senior person that is Singaporean or has lived in Singapore for a long time, because we've seen the importance of, you know, having a local person on the ground there. And I think that the success and failure that we've had over since 2018 there has really taught us what we need to get in place to make it work there now. And again, Singapore is a small place. You know, it serves the whole region, but don't forget it's the size of the Isle of Wight.
Absolutely. Yeah, when you put it like that, yeah. It is a small place. Why do you think the London office didn't work out, Justin?
So it goes back to knowing what you know really well, right? And I'd left, as I said to you at the beginning of this, I'd left London in 2008 and I went back to London from Dubai in 2016. And actually, we were experts with working with our clients in the Middle East and had just started in Asia, but we weren't experts in London. We didn't have we had clients that had offices there, but those clients in London had well-established PSLs that they were working with, and working with companies who had very well-known, groups of candidates. They had well-known networks, and we didn't have that. I relocated. I think when you try and open up an international office, and that's probably something important to say, I think you want to get a mixture of culture from your business, but also with knowledge of the local market. Okay, so I did send someone from Dubai over to London to work with someone that was in the London market, which I thought looked a great pairing, but actually they didn't really get on. And and on top of that, the person that I hired in London just wasn't as good as I thought they were going to be. And that meant that the person in Dubai that I'd sent over couldn't really offer that much because they didn't have a network. So it just didn't work out, you know, and it was, you know, it was turning into an expensive failure. And I think you've got to have the guts to go, you know what, this isn't working. Let's focus on what we're really good at. And it, you know, it goes back to being good at being in the Middle East and Asia.
How long, and like, when do you call that, Justin? Because that's a tough call. Like, you could think, we just need to be more persistent, give it longer. You know, we've cracked all these other markets. There's no reason we couldn't also be successful in London, right? And, you know, and think, okay, well, we had the wrong person or the wrong mix of people. We'll make some changes and keep going. How do you decide, you know what, let's cut our losses there and refocus our resources and our time and energy in the markets that, you know, we think we can be most successful in?
I think you've got to be honest with yourself. And that's the key thing in being, if you think about where I was geographically in Dubai, then I had a business in London, I had the business in Dubai, and I had the business in Hong Kong. When would I sleep? You know, it was, I think the other thing as well is, you know, there's only so much you as one individual can do. And it was it was quite obvious that other parts of the business were starting to suffer because my eyes were getting distracted into the, you know, London was going to need a lot of time and effort from me and from finding the right person, and I just asked myself that question, is it worth putting all that time and to taking me away from the core, which at the time was Dubai, to focus really hard onto London, which was, I didn't really know how to fix because I'd been out the market for so long, or is it better for me to focus on the core that makes us our money, and to go with help Adam, you know, in a bit that's really got lots of opportunities and it's quite clearly very similar. You know, there's a lot of similarity, more similarity with Dubai and Hong Kong than there was with London. Am I better served putting time into that? And the answer was yes, when you framed it up like that. And I also, you know, and I advise any business owner to do this. I have people, mentors or people that I trust and rely on, you know, in business who've been successful in business. And you just put your hand in the air and you go, you know what, I need help with this. And what would you do? And I gave my opinion. I went to them with what I thought was right. And 9 times out of 10, and that was, I think I should shut London. And they all agreed with me. And that really sort of cemented it as well.
Interesting. That is really interesting, Justin, how you came to that decision. Tell me, like, do you have a formula for deciding when to open a new office versus when to just keep hiring more people in an existing location? Like, why open a new region instead of just double down on Dubai or Hong Kong?
I do now. And that is because I've got gray hair and 12 years of experience, right? I think if you'd have asked me that question in in 2016, it was a lot more gut feel, and that's unsurprisingly why some things went well and some things didn't. I got lucky with the things that went well and not so with the things that didn't. And now it's and particularly with COVID, there's even less of a reason, some would say, to open up a physical office in a location. Yeah. I think for us, it comes down to percentage of revenue that comes out of an area. The fact that we've got clients that we can take into a certain region, and if we really think there's going to be something that we can add value from having those people on the ground. And I think in the parts of the world that we do business in, where cultural sensitivities are of a great importance, and actually in the Arabic world, FaceTime is incredibly important, and actually in Asia Pacific it is as well. It does make sense, but we'll take our time. What we do is we build a hub within our existing office that then, and that gets to a certain point where we think we'll get value from having boots on the ground. That's when we'll look to open it up. So for Singapore, we were doing 40% of our revenue from Hong Kong in Singapore. That in itself was justifiable, I felt, to have a license there. And actually having that license there then enabled us to pitch for work that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to do had we were serving it remote. So government contracts, etc., you need to have boots on the ground. But also being able to see people and that personal side really sort of added value to what we were doing remote. Our next offices that we will open will probably be the end of next year if all goes to plan. And they would be in the Middle East, would be in Riyadh, because Saudi is going through an enormous amount of change and spending, quite a significant amount on that. And there's a big opportunity there. And in Asia, it will be Japan, because that in itself is a very localized market. It's a very interesting market that, you just need to look at the amount of people on LinkedIn in Japan. It's not a lot. So actually having understanding of local cultural understanding, And having people on the ground who speak Japanese, who are familiar with the market and understand the cultural sensitivities there, that will serve and add to and have great value. But we'll start building that from Hong Kong probably. And then once we've got a runway, we'll then put people over there. And again, I did an interesting exercise with our Dubai and Hong Kong business recently, where I looked at where the revenue was coming from and why things were going well. And if there was, in Dubai, so many things came to Saudi, like even the clients that we were doing business with, who were agencies or consultancies, we were actually, even though the Dubai business was giving us the vacancy to work on, it was actually to service, if you looked at it deeper, to service Saudi Arabia business. So effect, was that a Dubai hire? Or was that a Saudi hire we were making for that client? So we've looked at it granular in that sense. And it's the same in Hong Kong. That's how I know that we've been at, why perhaps we haven't suffered from the lockdowns that Hong Kong and China have suffered from so much. It's because we've been able to use Hong Kong as a springboard to go into other markets.
Interesting. That's so cool. We have a surprising following in Japan for this podcast. I still, just last week, I had a connection request. Let me just give him a shout out here if I can quickly find it. No, I don't see it. I've been buried in too many others, but we've got a small but loyal listener base in Japan.
It's a fascinating market, and I think, have you had someone from Japan on your podcast before?
Twice we've had companies.
So about the rates there.
Suguru Narita. So hopefully he'll hear his name and get a kick out of that. So hey Suguru, thank you for following the Resilient Recruiter podcast.
There you go. I think that's actually one important thing I would say about the Middle East. So in the Middle East, it's a very transactional market. Actually, it's quite hard. People come here, you have to really negotiate very hard on your rates. A lot of people want something for nothing, and people will be quite surprised, even though they think it's the land of gold-plated Rolls Royces. Actually, people really will try and hit you for 10-12%, sometimes 8%. You've got to fight really hard to get your rates up. In Asia, they're much more respectful of the recruitment industry and the rates that we charge. And you can actually get, in somewhere like Japan, we just talked about, rates can go up to 40% for a hire.
Yes. Yes.
And I would say it's pretty standard to get 25% in Asia, and people don't really blink to that yeah. percentile. But in Dubai, you and Saudi and, you know, Qatar, etc., you really have to fight. And that's one of the interesting things I would say to anyone considering going into that market.
Yeah, I've been told by multiple people 35% in Japan is just the norm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in certain, for rare skills or situations, then you can get more than that.
It's old school headhunting, Mark. You know, it's you've got your Rolodex and you've got to try and find the right people for the job. And people stay in careers a lot longer than they do in other parts of the world there. So you moving them takes a lot.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Justin, something you've been really successful at is being a billing manager, because I know you've been a big biller yourself. You've done you've had years where you've done a million in personal billings, but you've simultaneously grown a team, and that's really challenging to pull off. We have a program for companies that want to scale called Apex, and it's for seven-figure firms that want to get to eight figures and build a business ultimately that runs without them that they could potentially exit. But getting from, like, let's say that million to 3 to 5 million and building from a handful of people to a larger team, it's brutal. Like, and trying to, because you're really wearing doing three jobs at once. You're running your own desk with your own clients and making placements. That's a full-time job. You're also recruiting, hiring, training other people. That could be a full-time job. And then you're also running the overall company. You know, you've got all this stuff you've talked about, like with expansion plans, deciding, making these decisions. You have to pay your taxes. You have to think about marketing, your website, your social media. You know, that could be a full-time business, almost the business management. How have you been able to pull that off? What are some of the keys?
Yeah, I think I don't think if we're going to continue to grow, myself and Adam are going to continue to play such a hands-on billing role. I think it's quite obvious now that we're probably reaching our threshold there with the size the business is at. But the key to being able to do that is, first of all, I think one thing we did at the start of COVID is we brought on a non-exec director to advise us on exactly how we could do that. So we have monthly catch-ups with Justin Pearson, who's our non-exec director, that's really sort of helped us take some of the load or the burden off our shoulders and look to push it to the employees that we've got and to give them established accounts to run with. And we're doing more of that now. The other thing is we've got a really good operations team. So I've got a CFO, two operations managers. We've also outsource. So we've got our CFO has also got spends 2 weeks of the month in Chennai in India and 2 weeks with us in Dubai. And we're building out an outsourcing accounting and delivery team in Chennai. And what we've also managed to do is to plug in an outsourced delivery team in, and we've actually got people in Sri Lanka and Manila as well that have really supported me, enabled me to deliver on the recruitment that I'm working on, whilst being quite hands-on in the managerial aspect of the business as well. And that's a system that we started to bring into employees now. So one of our lead guys in Dubai, Charlie, he's now got a lady called Anne that works closely with him. And it's like having two people, and it's doubled his capacity. And we've also then just given him someone in India who does all his CRM work for him as well. So all the data inputs and bullhorns, job adders, etc., we get that handled by someone else now. So and that's a system that I trialed with myself and that worked well. So it freed up my space to be able to run the business. And that's what I think would be, if someone's stretched, I would see what you can outsource.
Definitely.
And delegate to other people. That's really helped. But to give you a sort of an idea, Adam and I were contributing 60-70% of revenue at one point. And then we've taken that back as we've grown now to sort of 35-40%. And we're pushing that back even more. So most of the stuff that I do now is shared with individuals. So the clients still like to see me, but I'm actually pushing quite a bit of the work down to the individuals. And Adam's doing exactly the same in Asia. And that's enabled, you know, we are taking ourselves off that billing role over time, if you will. It's not been an immediate, you know, pull the ripcord and off we go. It's been a gradual process. And I think yes. that's worked quite well for us.
So phase one was delegating or offshoring the sort of sourcing part of the
of the
piece, but you were still account managing the process, you know, developing the client relationships and so on.
Yes.
And then as you've brought more team members into the business, you've been able to delegate more of the actual account, you know, account management part.
Yes.
And you are still overseeing that, but taking the lead in, you know, business development and then developing
yes.
the team.
Yes. I think, to be honest with you, it was, you know, you and I were working together in the early stages of COVID, right? And I saw
yep.
that you had, you know, staff members around the world, and Rachel was in Philippines, et cetera. So took some inspiration from you and other people I was talking to, and realized that, you know, if I was to really focus down on growing the business and getting us out of COVID, that I couldn't do everything. You couldn't try and do everything all on my own. And
definitely
hire, you know, I hired some really good people to work for our business, as did Adam. And we also outsourced elements of what we were doing as well. And that that the outsourcing element opened our eyes to possibilities, if I'm honest with you now, to
yes.
the point that I'm using it as a way of, you know, if you're someone like Charlie, for example, and you know, you've got a delivery person plugged into to your work, and you've got someone doing your handling your admin and CRM, that really frees you up to do the recruiting, you know, the bit that
yeah.
you enjoy, the sales, and that's a real reason to work for our business as well. And that's a real competitive advantage that I feel that we can bring, is that, you know, you can come and join us and really focus on doing what you're really good at. You know, and most salespeople I meet really like sales and don't like admin. Right?
Yeah, so, no, totally. That's right.
So we can take that away from them. So that's, you know, that's probably the reason we were able to do it, actually, Mark. And I haven't really, your question really opened my, it made me think about that. And I think that's one of the main reasons why.
Totally. So I guess bottom line, it's a gradual process. And,
yes.
But it's always this chicken and egg thing of like, at what point do you bring on, do you build out that infrastructure, hire the operations folks, have an actual like CFO or, you know, finance director, you know, how did you phase that in over time rather than being sort of an entrepreneurial business
yeah.
where you're doing pretty much everything to, you actually have people
yeah.
in place to, you've got that structure.
Well, you know, I've had the business for 12 years and actually bringing in good ops people was something I did early on in
okay.
back in the day, because having again, it goes back to your question about what's it like doing business in this part of the world. It was those days, it was very paper heavy. It was, there was a lot of red tape to navigate. So you really
yeah.
needed an ops and finance person to help you navigate some of that red tape and work with your local partner. And I saw, you know, I haven't had to deal with that for years. So I saw the value of having a solid operations team very quickly, and same in Hong Kong, which is still a very paper driven market, and Singapore to a degree. So ops people have been key to our success, and Adam and I we've been able to delegate that from the early days of the business, and actually they were so vital during COVID as well, because we always knew where we were. We always, you know, if I wanted a reality check, because a lot of people have got anxiety about what's around the corner next year and during COVID. And what I needed was a constant reminder and reality check. And having a good CFO always gave you that. You knew the world wasn't going to end. You knew where you were financially. You knew how the business was placed. You knew what the cash was in the bank. You knew the situation. And it was, you know, it was having that reassurance was key to our success and growth coming out of COVID.
Really interesting. So you said you had you brought that operations team online pretty early days. Like, how headcount wise, at what point, well, was it a revenue or was it a headcount? What was the trigger to say, do you know what, we need some operational support now?
Yeah. It was about our sixth hire was the first operations person
okay.
we brought on. But actually, I had an accountant from day one, right?
Of course.
So
yeah.
I brought And then that accountant, I was sort of leaning on heavily. And then I brought in Centil, our CFO. He was about employee number 7 or 8. So I've actually brought them on quite quickly. And it was as we were starting, we were probably on 7 figures, just as we were hit 7 figures. And it was, you know, it was becoming too much for the accountant and hiring people and all the red tape that was involved within that. It was, it was just too much for me to handle. So, so that's why I brought that individual on very quickly. And I knew, you know, I think you have to be honest with yourself and what you're good at and what you're not, right? And
totally.
As my score reports always showed, I was, you know, admin was never my strong point.
So it was about when you're at the threshold of 7 figures and you think it was about your 6th hire.
We were in 7 figure world, but we were looking to grow. And I knew that the only way we could grow is if we freed up some capacity. And, you know, I was thinking about future proofing us then. And also I had in mind that I wanted to go into another market as well. And I needed research and intel on those markets, what the cost would be, you know, how you get your business license, et cetera. It's incredibly time consuming that. And you need a good operations person to do it. And you need, you know, I think it's probably on average cost us 6 figure, you know, 100,000 to 150,000 just to open up an office, just in getting. That's the administration aspect, let alone the hiring, because you have to prove you've got money in the bank. You have to go through, pay all for the various stamps that you need and the various paperwork, et cetera. And that, you know, I think you also have to show that you've got a track record of being a successful business in your other country. So there's lots of hoops you need to jump through administrative wise. And I knew I needed people, you know, with me to do that.
Yeah, that would not be my forte for sure. So when you brought Centil on board, was he a CFO straight away, or has he grown into that role as the company is?
Well, he was our finance director, and it's grown into CFO. Yeah. And he was working sort of initially part time, so 50% with us, 50% with an advertising company, and then moved on full time to us. So
cool.
And that's, you know, and I've also in my period of running businesses, I had a learning and development business that I, you know, helped, that I put money into and exited, and he was involved in that as well.
Cool. That's amazing, Justin. So a lot of people, like, there's varying opinions and projections about what's going to happen in 2023. You know, to what extent things are going to slow down. It's very strange because, it's still a very tight, talent market. And lots of companies still hiring like crazy. What are you predicting?
For me, it really is key that I think people, I mean, there's kind of like 4 tips I would share on that, right? And I would say, first of all, do not pay attention to any macroeconomic news, because there's plenty of bad news out there that you can sort of be drawn into and focus on, you know. I think just focus on your situation, and that's the best way you can get through it. If you're a business owner, have regular meetings with your CFO and make sure that you understand what your financial situation is. Do a worst case scenario exercise. You know, that's definitely something that I would do. And don't panic. Just take a moment to think to yourself about how you would get through this situation. And for many people, just remember that you got through COVID. It wasn't that long ago. And, you know, that's as bad as everyone thought it could get. And we all came out of it the other side. And in our areas, fortunately, we're not seeing any change in the job flow at all. So long may that continue. And I think, you know, being specific skill sets and having good talent is still going to be in high demand. They're seeing no slowdown within that as well, particularly within our, you know, sectors where digital plays such a huge part. But digital skills just seem to be in heavy demand more and more.
100%. Those 4 tips are priceless, Justin. And from someone who's been through 3 downturns already, and, you know, and you've survived and continued to grow, that's really, agree 100%. Like, first and foremost, do not panic. That's, you know, when you don't make good decisions is
Absolutely.
When you go into panic mode. You've got this. Like, I think that's what I'm telling all my clients who are asking about, like, what's, you know, what changes should we make, is you've got this. Like, you're, as long as you're paying attention, as you say, like, stay close to your finances, focus on what you're great at. And, you know, you're going to get through this
Absolutely. Agree.
Awesome. Well, listen, I've really enjoyed reconnecting with you, Justin. Thanks for doing the next chapter. Say hi to Helen for me.
I will.
And let's do this again, but not wait 2 years, because
absolutely,
you guys are exploding, and I want to stay closer to what you guys are doing. So let's talk again soon.
Thanks, Mark. Would love to. Cheers. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
Take care.